Holding a banquet in a tent has a charm someone like Donald Trump can't possibly grasp. The Obamas loved doing it, held five state banquets on the South Lawn, black tie, under canvas, and even one summer night in 2011 had a banquet for Angela Merkel under the stars. But that's not Trump. He needs pillars, marble and chandeliers. So he's torn down the East Wing to build a ballroom. It's going to be big. 16 times bigger than the chamber at Windsor Castle, where he ate in September. That night, only 160 guests sat down with him and the King. His ballroom will seat 650. This, as my next guest, Jan Werner Müller, pointed out in The Guardian recently, is a global trend right now. Populist leaders celebrating themselves by building spectacular buildings. Jan Werner Müller is Professor of Politics at Princeton University. Jan, welcome to Late Night Live.
Thank you very much for having me on the program.
Jan, tinkering with the White House is an old presidential routine. Lots of them have done it.
So, yes, there have been now many discussions about how many, many presidents have done things. Sometimes, like Truman, even had to do things because the place was literally falling apart. But in terms of size, in terms of changing the basic structure, this is pretty much unprecedented. And as Trump himself has always said, to some degree, this is also really on one level about demonstrating, you know, what makes him special as a developer. And if I may add, it also in a sense is about demonstrating power and simply creating facts, putting in place a structure that will not be easily undone if it's ever undone.
I haven't compared the footprints of the new wing that's being built with the old White House, but it looks as though this ballroom is actually going to have a bigger footprint than the White House itself.
That has been reported, and given that architecture inevitably always also has a symbolic meaning, it of course does make a strange impression to say that, okay, the ballroom seems somehow now more important than, you know, the core functions of government. Plus, as everybody has been saying rightly, it is also extremely problematic to have the whole thing financed by private donors. Of course, they're trying to run a story that says, oh, look, you know, this saves some taxpayers' money. But there's a reason why we don't use private money for public buildings, because it obviously creates an impression of corruption. And as everybody knows by now, there is indeed also a reality of corruption in the United States after Trump came back into office. So that's also a very problematic aspect of this whole endeavor.
Did I read the other day that some of the donors want to keep their names secret?
That has been indeed reported. Again, it's a massive problem that clearly, why would one want to keep one's name secret unless there was something slightly nefarious or one wanted
exactly
to hide a certain kind of influence on the president? So this goes against really the most basic principles of how a democratic government should conduct itself.
The decor of the plan. Lots of chandeliers, gold, of course, quite a lot of gold detailing. Corinthian columns. I wonder, Jan, whether the Corinthian order is the order for despots.
I think we should be careful to equate particular styles with one particular tendency. It was very common to do that when you look at, you know, the sort of worst examples of 20th century totalitarian architecture. People said, look, you know, so-called stripped neoclassicism, that was the architecture of Albert Speer and Hitler. But it's a really more complicated picture. There was also, for instance, a lot of very good modernist architecture in fascist Italy. Even in Germany, there were actually some buildings that actually look pretty modern.
Speer wasn't a bad architect.
And by the same token, well, yes, I mean, it's a complicated question.
Yes.
Of, you know, how do we think about the quality and then the style? I think what is odd about Trump when you think about it is that, of course, he has already issued a number of executive orders where he basically decrees from on high, classicism is our style. You know, this is what the United States is about. His own buildings, for that matter, are actually sort of quite bland in their modern style. And it's only on the inside that you have, as you said, all this kind of wannabe Versailles, or as some American critics have now been calling it, regional car dealership Rococo, which I think is a very nice way of putting it.
It's brutal.
In terms of this completely garish. It's the nation's architecture, Kate Wagner. So, you know, credit where credit is due, who came up with this idea.
But Jan, to declare that the classical style is American, this is the American style, is not altogether wrong, is it? Because you can look, you know, there is the White House, there are those antebellum mansions in the Deep South, there is the Supreme Court. Again and again, these are classical buildings, and they are the sort of icons of American architecture.
Yes, with, if you allow me, three small caveats. So, number one, those who originally opted for the style, so Thomas Jefferson, for instance, were also very keen to say, let's not make this too grand and pompous. They wanted something that looked small R Republican, you know, a kind of the citizen ideally as agrarian person, self-reliant, maybe even with a weapon, not something that looked too much like an ostentatious palace. And if you look at Jefferson's own designs, he actually submitted a design for the White House under a pseudonym. It's really not like the ballroom at all. So that's point number one. Point number two, as you also said, there is also a distinct association with the South. In a sense, this is also a legacy that has to be factored in. One can't pretend that doesn't exist. And thirdly, I think that's a good argument to be made for, well, we do live in different times now. You also have an opportunity to make different gestures with architecture. Many classical buildings in their own way can be quite bland. If you look at many things that have been built in that style, let's say regional courthouses in the US, they're not particularly interesting. So I'm not saying that, you know, this somehow should be prohibited as a style. But I think we should also not automatically default into it and then accept it simply because somebody decrees this is the American way.
And a decree that public buildings have got to be built in a particular style is just ludicrous. I mean, and very much the whim of a dictator, wouldn't you say?
So it's certainly problematic if somebody decrees artistic aesthetic choices from on high. It fits into a larger global pattern where it's for shorthand right-wing populists in particular who basically have tried to communicate something about how they understand what they often call the real people or the proper people. So some kind of image of what, you know, the ideal American or let's say the ideal Hungarian or the ideal Turk looks like, what kind of traditions they draw on. So a lot of these figures have used buildings to convey a message about that. They've also tried to convey the message that in many cases they've won, you know, big majorities at the polls. They put something out there that cannot be undone easily. It's a way of telling also the opposition and other citizens, look, you know, we've really done it. We're here now. You know, we're putting this in your face and you can't do anything about it.
And also that they are authentic. Isn't that part of the claim that these buildings make? I, the builder of that building, I am showing you that I am authentic because I'm drawing on the traditions of the country. I'm asserting all of these kind of half-familiar tropes or very familiar tropes of architecture. I represent you.
Very clear answer on my part, yes and no. So yes, in the sense that these figures do say that they and only they represent what they often call the real people. So I completely agree that that's part of the package. But the no consists in pointing out that, as a matter of fact, a lot of them, of course, are not actually in any way faithful to, let's say, original building methods. Very, very many of them are basically about decoration, which is another way of saying you build something with concrete and then you basically put something on it.
Yes.
That gestures at the past. But it's really not, you know, a faithful reconstruction of anything by any stretch of the imagination.
Despots can build well, can't they? I'm thinking.
It depends.
I'm thinking, you know, Rome, St. Petersburg, London at various stages, appalling governments, beautiful architecture.
Again, I think we should, you know, be careful of how we link politics and architecture. So you're right that we can't say that, oh, just because it was built under a more or less authoritarian regime, therefore it must be bad architecture. Or that anything built under democracies is necessarily better. But it also depends what then people make of these buildings.
So, yes.
You know, you can find many examples where something has been built, even with a quite clear and obvious authoritarian intention, but then the people themselves were able to appropriate the building, change the meaning of the building. That's also true, for instance, of cities, of big squares, which, you know, as you know, authoritarians also like to have soldiers, you know, march up and down, demonstrate power. But, you know, people have some power over how these edifices are being read and interpreted.
And even by coming to love them, they can change their meaning. Because in a sense, those buildings then become genuinely part of the tradition of that country. So that, you know, very beautiful buildings in London, something like the Banquet House or something, built by James I, which is not the worst leader Britain's ever had, but it becomes loved and therefore part of the nation.
Yes, things clearly change over time. We also shouldn't forget that the sometimes very heated debates around the choice of, let's say, styles are often forgotten. So it's long forgotten that, you know, since he brought up Britain in the 19th century after the House of Commons had burned down, House of Parliament had burned down, there was this incredible debate about should we rebuild in the Gothic style or classical. In those days, classical was rejected because it was seen as revolutionary, was associated with the French and the American revolutions. I think few people would remember that today and, you know, sort of say, well, you know, what if we, you know, rebuilt in classical? How would that have changed, you know, our understanding of history?
I think the world is pretty happy with the result of the Palace of Westminster, don't you think?
Absolutely. The only thing, as everybody knows, it's falling apart and it's been fiendishly difficult to try to renovate it.
That's right. It's just sinking into the river. On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr and I'm speaking to the professor of politics at Princeton University, Jan Venemula, about the world trend at the moment for populist leaders to be building architecture of a certain style. Jan, Erdogan in Turkey seems to be sort of almost the poster boy of this trend. Yet when I look at the buildings he's building, they don't seem to me to be particularly sort of Turkish. They're sort of very substantial, but not sort of folkloric in any way.
Well, I might slightly disagree. I think if you look at his presidential palace in Ankara, I think it was clearly gesturing at a so-called Ottoman Seljuk style. It was also another enormous grand building. It sort of violated all kinds of environmental laws, a little bit like Trump is constantly violating laws. But above all, I think Erdogan has been very keen to build, you know, very large mosques. There's now one that is absolutely gigantic in Istanbul. You basically see it from almost anywhere in the city. He built a new airport. As soon as you exit that airport, you see a fairly large mosque. So I think it's not an accident that with someone like Erdogan in Turkey, or let's say Modi in India, where, again, going back to our earlier discussion, there's a sort of the understanding of the people as, let's say, primarily or maybe even exclusively Muslim or as Hindu, that actually the main emphasis is on temples, mosques. It's not always, strictly speaking, government buildings that are most important for these kinds of leaders.
You make the point in the Guardian story that you wrote that Modi has used a Hindu temple to wipe out a mosque, and very, very deliberately using that architecture to wipe out another tradition.
Yes, I mean, to be fair, he didn't sort of, you know, destroy the mosque, but he basically built on a site that was very controversial. And he does fit a pattern which I think we see in a number of countries where leaders quite consciously, so to speak, remove one layer of history, which they see as, to go back to your earlier term, inauthentic or somehow betraying the real people or the authentic national tradition, and then literally build something on top that basically erases whatever was there before. So you see this with Modi and Hindu temples in relation to mosques. You see this to some degree in Hungary with Orban's so-called reconstruction of Habsburg-era buildings, where it's the layer of fairly modern, sometimes modernist, buildings that were erected under state socialism that completely disappear from the scene. So these are all always very powerful symbolic gestures in terms of erasing certain layers of history and then telling people this is what we are really about.
Yes, this is us. And you've been talking for a moment about churches and mosques, and it seems to me really fascinating that the man that Trump has hired to build this monstrous ballroom, his real sort of practice is in building churches.
The story, as it has been reported, abounds in ironies. So he was initially a pupil, if that's the right word, of Peter Eisenman, the famous American architect who was one of the main protagonists of so-called deconstructivist architecture, the very thing that Trump's latest executive order decreeing style explicitly condemns, that it says it's disorder, it's problematic, things should never be built this way. But then apparently he had a revelation and he disowned that particular approach and then turned to specializing in religious buildings. It's been reported that his old mentor, Peter Eisenman, looked at some of the designs and with unmatched condescension, you might say, called them untutored. Of course, we don't know what exactly will be built in the end, but quite a few people have looked at whatever has been revealed about the designs and have noticed some flaws or some very incoherent sort of approaches about where windows and stairs are and so on. So you might even say, in a weird way, if it stays that incoherent, even though it wasn't meant to be deconstruction, it might actually end up at this inadvertently.
Yes. Jan, look, I'm just an amateur lover of architecture, but I can't help feeling the building would look better with a dome on top. What do you think?
I mean, it would have been just better to leave things as they are.
As they were, and
not mess with this, and also then again resist a little bit the temptation too easily to identify even particular shapes or even particular materials like glass with things like democracy. That's also been very prevalent in the last couple of decades. People look at the German parliament in Berlin, Norman Foster's famous dome, and they say, oh, this is, you know, the absolute symbol of democracy. It's transparent, and the people are on top of their own deputies. They look down on their politicians. This shows that they are sovereign. People forget that Foster didn't actually want this dome at all, and that a couple of pretty authoritarian countries have precisely copied this sort of dome approach, and it has not exactly made them more democratic.
But waiting in the wings is Trump's plan to build a triumphal arch in Washington. Are you as excited about that as I am?
So we don't know quite how bad this will be in the end. Again, it's entirely fitting with his approach, and it is in a sense a sign of in a sense autocratic ambitions. At the same time, again, forgive me for being pedantic, we should not be too quick. You know, it's almost forgotten that, you know, a perfectly democratic French president, François Mitterrand, in the 1980s also had a lot of so-called grand projects in those days, and wanted to kind of leave an imprint on the city. So I think we should not immediately now jump up and down every single time that, you know, Trump floats in the air of what he wants to build. But the details are telling, and I think the details should be condemned, the proportions should be condemned, and basically ignoring laws and violating existing regulations should also be condemned.
There are leaders who, as you say, would have loved to build, would have loved to fix their cities, do great things like that, but feared to do so because of the political consequences of spending so much money, of making such changes. One of the things about Trump is that he seems not to fear any of the consequences of this, let alone the possibility that it will make him a joke.
It's true that what is distinctive about especially the second term is that, unlike in other countries where many leaders try to at least keep up a facade of legality and actually invested quite a lot of time and energy into fooling outside observers into thinking that, yeah, everything was done legally and correctly, Trump, as president, acts pretty much like Trump the businessman in New York City, which is to say, do something that is obviously illegal, and everybody knows it's illegal. But basically, then you sort of wait and see what happens. Do other people arrange themselves? Are they actually going to go to court? Might they settle outside of court? So that is really quite distinctive. And of course, it sends soul to his followers as, look, he's so decisive. He actually does stuff. And it's true, alas, that of course, on one level, yes, he is creating facts. You cannot easily undo certain things. And in that sense, he sort of remains the person, as we nowadays like to say, driving the narrative, being at the center of attention and so on. And that is, of course, its own form of power.
Jan, thank you so much for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
I've been talking to Jan Werner Müller, Professor of Politics at Princeton University, about the latest buildings of Donald Trump.